McGill University and will tell us about whether, or ask the question whether modal polarization is the holy grail to communication.
So thanks a lot for the invitation. Now, whenever you see a title with a question mark, you know that the answer is what you know. In fact, if you read the abstract at the top, you see that that's what I'm going to argue. So this is mainly a common ground sentiment, but I'm sure that all of you have heard about the bicep results. So who has not heard about the bicep results? The bicep results were heralded as a great triumph of inflationary cosmology. There were press releases saying that this is confirmed inflation, and we now know that the universe started with a phase of exponential expansion. And, well, if you look at where the press releases came from, it was mainly Stanford. So there's a PS to that press announcement, which you can read between the lines. B-mode polarization as a holy grail of inflation. Cosmologists have been talking about this for years. And
could you turn the microphone on, please?
Okay. I wanted to get
away without doing this.
Good job.
Good try, yes. I failed to do that. Now, 3 years ago, I got upset at hearing this false claim that B-mode polarization is a holy grail of inflation. So 3 years ago, I posted something on the archive without the intention of publishing it, of submitting it to a journal. So there's something on the archive 3 years ago with exactly this title. But people are still talking about B-mode polarization as a holy grail of inflation. And I'm going to argue that this is far from the truth. So I'm going to show you in this talk that B-mode polarization can be produced many different ways, not necessarily primordially, not necessarily by gravitational waves, not necessarily by inflation. And I'll give you some examples. So this is the result that has attracted a huge amount of attention when it was released in March. So this is a plot of the angular power spectrum of B-mode polarization of the cosmic microwave background. So cosmic microwave background, you take the polarization, you take the B-mode component. This is multipole moment, this is amplitude. Large angular scales, smaller angular scales. And these black dots with the error bars are the data from this bicep experiment. Now, there are various curves that you see. There's a curve zero, which means no polarization. Then there's a red solid curve, which is contribution to B-mode polarization from something that is not B-mode polarization, something that's primordially E-mode polarization. And then there's a dashed curve, which is a predicted B-mode polarization if you had a spectrum of cosmological perturbations in the very early universe, which was scale invariant. So that's this dashed curve, scale invariant. And compared with that, this is the data. So preview, inflation is a theory of the very early universe which predicts a spectrum of gravitational waves, which predicts CMB polarization, which predicts a roughly scale invariant spectrum of perturbations, but with a necessarily red tilt. Red tilt means less power at high frequencies than scale invariant, less power on shorter wavelengths than scale invariant. So now if you look at this plot, this is high frequencies, this is low frequencies, this is scale invariant, here's the data. The data has been in support of inflation. inflation produces a red tilt, less power than scale invariant on small angular scales. So this is obviously a red tilt, which you see, isn't it? Obviously, it's not a red tilt. So you see, even looking at this data, there is no support whatsoever of the main claim of inflation, namely that you have a red tilt of the spectrum of gravitational waves. OK, so.
Red tilt for all possible
inflation. All possible versions of inflation, as opposed to the spectrum of cosmological perturbations. The density perturbations can have both a red tilt and a blue tilt. For simple models, you get a red tilt. You can construct complicated models which produce a blue tilt for the density perturbations, not for the gravitational waves, unless you violate the energy conditions. OK. So this is the data.
Can we say, from the supposed red tilt, people say that they have found in the CMB itself, can you predict how much red tilt should have been?
Yep. In simple inflationary models.
Because
you see, in general, we don't know what the red tilt is for the density perturbations. So therefore, we cannot make a general statement for inflation. The only definite statement we can make is that there is a red tilt of gravitational waves. Right. For simple inflationary models, we can...
It's clear that we don't see a red tilt in that, but is it badly in disagreement with the predicted red tilt?
No, because of the error bars.
Yeah.
Okay, but let me step back. Given this data, we have to ask the following question. Is the signal cosmological, or is the signal from dust? Now, those of you who are cosmologists in the audience will know that serious doubts have been raised whether this data is actually cosmological or whether it's dust. And I'm not going to address this question. I'm going to assume that the signal actually is cosmological. But I'm going to mention one way of answering the question, whether the signal is from dust. And there's a very interesting paper by Colley and Gott. Gott is at Princeton. And they suggested using the genus statistic as a way to discriminate between dust and cosmological foreground. So what Colley and Gott did is they took dust maps and they computed the genus statistic of dust maps, and they found that it's not Gaussian, whereas a cosmological signal should be Gaussian. And so based on that, Gott and Colley argue that the signal from BICEP is probably cosmological.
What do you mean by genus?
Okay, I was hoping that someone would ask a question. So now the genus statistic is a way of quantifying data which is diametrically different from just computing correlation functions, 2-point, 3-point, and 4-point correlation functions. So the genus is one of a member of topological statistics. So let's assume that you have a map, for example, a temperature map, maybe in two dimensions. So what you can do with this nice map is you can fix the temperature. And then for any temperature, the constant temperature surface will have a particular characteristic. It will have a particular genus. Number of disconnected components minus number of holes. So this is a way to characterize a surface. And then you basically, if it's Gaussian, then you find some Gaussian curve about the mean temperature. So this is a genus statistic. It's a way to quantify data which is very different than correlation functions, and it is sensitive to non-Gaussian features. Now, the genus is actually one member of a class of statistics called Minkowski functionals. And for d-dimensional maps, there are d plus one Minkowski functionals. The genus is not the most sensitive of these maps. So someone should repeat this analysis using the more sensitive Minkowski functionals. OK, so for the rest of the talk, I'm going to assume that BICEP, the BICEP signal, is cosmological, that it's not dust. But then you have to ask, assuming that it's cosmological, is a signal from gravitational waves or not? And I will actually show you ways to produce B-mode polarization, which does not involve gravitational waves. But then I will go on and argue that probably that the mechanism of producing B-mode polarization, not the gravitational waves, is probably not the one that gives the bicep data. So then I will assume that the signal is from gravitational waves. Then the question is the signal primordial? Primordial, I mean from the very early universe. And I will show you that there are ways to produce gravitational waves which are not primordial. But let's assume that the signal is primordial. Then the next question is the signal from inflation? And then I would argue that most likely not. So, the message...
I'm sure you said it twice, but to make sure. The analysis using this genius statistic was unfavorable to the idea that it's dust.
That's right. But it was not using the dust map of the bicep region, because the authors did not have access to that information. So what I'm mentioning this just as a way to, in the future, answer the question whether the signal is from dust or not. Okay. So now I want you to walk away from this talk with five messages. Three of them robust, two of them provocative. So first message is there are sources of B-mode polarization other than gravitational waves. Second, there are other sources of gravitational waves than primordial fluctuations. And third, there are early universe scenarios different than inflation, which predict a large amplitude of primordial gravitational waves. These are robust messages. Now, the provocative message are the following. Inflationary models, which are in the realm of applicability of effective field theory, because inflation is based on doing classical GR coupled with matter which we understand at low energies. So it ought to be in the realm of applicability of effective field theory. So I will argue that those inflationary universe models generically predict a small amplitude of gravitational waves. So therefore, measuring a large amplitude of gravitational waves disfavors inflation. So therefore, detecting a large value of gravitational waves is more likely to disprove than prove inflation.
Just so you're not holding us in suspense unless you really want to. By that you mean that it would have to range over at least 90 super Planckian range. Yes? Or do you mean something else?
High energy scale of inflation. Not necessarily super Planckian field range. High energy scale of inflation is sufficient. In the simple models that I know, it will also involve super Planckian, but it's the high energy is more important. Yeah?
Speaking of provocative comments, there's a paper by Ancho, Little, Marina Cortez, and collaborators, which I think they're saying that if there is a lot of dust, exactly what the bicep signal is doesn't matter. If there is a lot of dust, then we will be unable to distinguish between these hypotheses.
No, but this is basically a way to distinguish. If given dust maps, you can compute the topology of dust maps. And if you know that, then you can extract a cosmological signal, even if the amplitude of the cosmological signal is smaller than the amplitude of the dust.
Wait, the claim is that this genus and the other observables you mentioned are so good that even if the dust dominates the B-mode signal, you can subtract it out sufficiently to distinguish the real value of R.
Well, that depends on what the real value of R is, yes. But we can go way beyond. See, the Planck paper that was released a couple of weeks ago indicates that dust contributes comparably to bicep interpreted as primordial. So we don't have to dig deep.
Well, right. So that paper says that the dust is similar to an R equals 0.2 distribution.
Yeah, but that's just amplitude. What I'm saying is that if you can measure the non-Gaussian statistics of dust, you can basically dig out the Gaussian contribution.
Okay.
even if the amplitude is smaller.
That would be fabulous.
So anyway, there are ways of answering this question. Anyway, for the rest of the talk, let me assume that the signal is cosmological, but I will argue that in no way is it necessarily due to inflation. Okay. Good. So first I'm going to show you a way of generating B-mode polarization, which is not due to gravitational waves. It's due to topological defects. So, okay. So many particle physics models beyond the standard model predict the existence of topological defects, for example, cosmic strings. Now, if you have a particle physics model which predicts cosmic strings, then a network of cosmic strings will form in the early universe and will survive to the present time. And in each horizon volume, there will be a fixed number of cosmic strings. And I will show you that each such string will generate B-mode polarization. Let me jump back. Okay. So what I'm going to argue is that cosmic string wakes, which are overdense regions which form behind long moving strings, lead to direct B-mode polarization. Okay, so let's consider a cosmic string. So imagine a long string pointing out at you. Space perpendicular to this string is conical, so there's a deficit angle. And the deficit angle is proportional to the tension of a string, as given by this equation. So if you consider this, for example, us being here, observing the microwave radiation coming to us from different directions in the sky, then if a string is here moving with velocity v in this direction, we will see a Doppler shift between this photon and this photon. That's a lensing effect. However, the string will also produce an overdense region behind it. So I draw the same picture. The string is moving with velocity v. This line is identified to this line. We are sitting here. And we are looking at the gas through which this string is moving. Now, from the point of view of the observer behind this string, you see a velocity perturbation, delta V, of the gas towards us. And so, therefore, a moving string will produce an overdensity in its wake, a region in which the density is twice the overdensity, as indicated here. And this is the geometry of such a wake, an overdense region. At a string present at some time ti, between recombination and the present time, will have extent ti in this direction. In this direction, its extent is given by the velocity times ti, and its thickness is given by this deficit angle times ti. Now, once this overdense region is formed, so you have this wake formed, overdense region, it will attract matter from above and below, which means that as a function of time, this overdense region will grow. And it will grow in a way that can be computed using linear perturbation theory or the Zeldovich approximation. So you look at shells of matter, which initially are a certain height above the wake. Initially, the mass is moving away because the universe is expanding, but due to the gravity, eventually the mass turns around. This is the way that you can compute the thickness. And what you find is that the thickness grows in time proportional to the scale factor. So the thickness, h, grows proportional to a. So a wake is a region of enhanced free electrons. And cosmic microwave background photons, which are emitted at the time of recombination, they will acquire extra polarization when they pass through a wake. Because cosmic microwave background polarization is produced by microwave photons passing through overdense regions. Now, in contrast to spherical perturbations, where there is no direction, for a cosmic string wake, there is a direction which is different from the direction picked out by the cosmic microwave background dipole. It's the tangent vector to the string. And so this extra polarization has equal strength B mode and E mode. So cosmic string wakes generate equal strength E mode and B mode polarization. In particular, they generate direct B mode polarization, whereas usual Gaussian perturbations generate no direct B mode polarization. Absolutely. And you should also see that this B-mode polarization map will be highly non-Gaussian. So yes, so this cosmic string hypothesis of generating B-mode polarization makes other predictions too. Makes predictions about EB correlation. Actually, what you find that there is no correlation between E-mode and B-mode from the entire. So the EB cross-correlation at leading order from the wakes vanishes.
Because of parity.
Yeah. But the main discriminant of this mechanism is that you have a non-Gaussian signal. Because the signal is where the wakes intersect the past light curve. So in position space, you have a very distinct prediction.
So I think cosmic strings also generate B-modes through generating gravitational.
Yeah, this is the slides I'll come back to. The slides I skipped over before.
Okay.
Yep.
Just a quick question. Do you, like amplitude-wise, is this effect like dominant over that? Or?
No, it's not dominant. Okay. This effect is not dominant in terms of the power spectrum. In terms of the local effect, yes, it is dominant. And so let's see. Let's compute the polarization. Amplitude divided by the quadrupole amplitude. So the effect is given by Thomson scattering. And so the amplitude of polarization divided by the amplitude of the quadrupole is given by Thomson cross-section times something which involves the width of the width of the wake multiplied by some redshift factors which describe how much the wake has had time to grow. And if you put in numbers, you basically find that the amplitude of polarization is equal to the amplitude of the quadrupole multiplied by this ugly expression. And this ugly expression is a large number multiplied by the tension of a string in dimensionless units. And this g mu is a small number. It depends on the tension of a string. And the g mu values that we are interested in for cosmology is g mu smaller than 10 to the minus 7. Because g mu equals 10 to the minus 7 is the current upper bound on the cosmic string tension. So you see that for strings which are not yet ruled out, the smallness of g mu cancels the largeness of this factor 10 to the 7. But you still get something which is not, which locally is not suppressed. So locally you get a magnitude of polarization which is comparable to the magnitude of the quadrupole. But that's only local. If you compute the power spectrum, you get a power spectrum which is completely degenerate with the power spectrum of B-mode polarization induced by lensing from E-mode. This is now for the experts. And I can go into the results. So, which means that in two-point correlation functions, you will not see this signal. And also, at large scales, this signal is very small. So this mechanism, so here I've shown you that there are ways of generating B-mode polarization, which do not involve gravitational waves. But this particular mechanism is weak on large angular scales. So let's assume that the BISEC data is correct, and therefore this is not the explanation of the BISEC data. Then we go back to what Takeshi asked. So, topological defects, cosmic strings, they are dynamical objects, and they lead to gravitational wave production on all scales. So cosmic strings are direct sources of gravitational waves, and the spectrum of gravitational waves from a network of cosmic strings is scale invariant, in the same way that a spectrum of gravitational waves from inflation is scale invariant. And generically, you get a large amplitude of gravitational waves, which will be induced at recombination from cosmic strings. And in fact, for cosmic strings with a large tension, with a tension which is close to the current limit, you find that you get a value of gravitational waves, which is close to the Biseck result. So typically, if there are cosmic strings around, cosmic strings will produce a lot of gravitational waves. And so if all you see in the sky is a signal of gravitational waves with a scale invariant spectrum, then it is more likely cosmic strings than something primordial.
Is there an intuitive reason why to see why it should be scale invariant?
Yeah. Yeah, this comes from the, so this is specific to cosmic strings.
Right.
Cosmic strings have a scaling solution. That means that the network of strings looks the same at all times, scaled to the Hubble radius. That gives rise to the scale invariant spectrum. So that's a clear reason. The cosmological perturbations themselves produced by cosmic strings are also scale invariant. But let's imagine that there are no cosmic strings. So let me go on.
So what is it that, sorry, just a question, what is it that rules out the cosmic string? What sets the bound of cosmic string? Since if they're just producing scale invariant,
right? CMB. Okay, so the strongest bound on the cosmic string tension, so the mu is the tension of a string, symmetry breaking scale square, that comes from the angular power spectrum of the temperature maps. And let me jump ahead, since you asked that question. It comes from this data. So this is now the temperature, the angular power spectrum of the temperature anisotropies. So angular scale, temperature anisotropies. You see these acoustic oscillations. A cosmic string model will not produce these acoustic oscillations. It will produce a broad Doppler peak. So the fact that we see these acoustic oscillations means that the cosmic string, that cosmic strings cannot be the dominant mechanism of generating density perturbations. And that sets this limit. Okay. So again, I've shown you so far that there are ways of generating B-mode polarization which don't involve gravitational waves. I've shown you that there are ways of generating gravitational waves on large angular scales which are not primordial. But now let's turn to primordial sources of gravitational waves, early universe scenario. And what I'm going to argue is that there are ways other than inflation for producing gravitational waves with a scaling down spectrum. OK. So this is the beautiful data that we now have about the temperature anisotropies, the angular power spectrum of the microwave temperature anisotropy. So any theory of the early universe has to be consistent with this data. And so the data is the black dots with statistical errors and a systematic uncertainty. And the red curve is a prediction of inflation with six parameters tuned. But actually, it is not a prediction of inflation. It is a prediction that was made 10 years before inflation. It was made in two beautiful papers, one of them by Zunyaev and Zeldovich, and the other one by Peebles and Yu. And here's a slide that illustrates the key physics. It's a very poor reproduction of a plot in the paper of Zeldovich and Zunyaev of 1970, 10 years before inflation. And this is space. this is time, and this is the gene's length. So if you have density fluctuations in an expanding universe, then on scales, length scales smaller than a gene's length, perturbations will oscillate. Whereas on length scales larger than the gene's length, perturbations are frozen in. So here you see two different wavelengths entering the gene's length, starting to oscillate. And what Peebles and you and Sunyaev and Zelovich realized is that if you look at, if you compare different waves, if you look at different wavelengths, and you look at the time of recombination, then different wavelengths will have undergone a different number of oscillations by the time of recombination. And now I want to draw one more diagram on the board. This is a space-time sketch, time and space. So this is recombination, the time when the photons are released. If you have density fluctuations at recombination, then the surface of fixed temperature is perturbed. And so if you look at photons, photons in different directions will have undergone different redshifts. So this sketch illustrates that density perturbations at recombination will produce microwave anisotropies. So now if we see one wave which we catch at maximal extension, it will produce a peak. Whereas if you take a wave which has undergone an even quarter multiplet of oscillations, we will catch the wave when it's constant amplitude, when it just has a velocity perturbation. So, and that means that it will have no gravitational redshift. So this sketch here shows that in order to produce these kind of that these oscillations in the angular power spectrum are simply a result of assuming that there are fluctuations on scales larger than the gene's length, which gradually enter the gene's length. There's absolutely nothing about inflation which is special to this feature. So these acoustic oscillations in the angular power spectrum of microwave anisotropies was discussed and well understood 10 years before inflation. And so in no way is the observation of this curve a proof of inflation.
Does not the heights of the peaks tell you something about approximate scale and variance?
Nope. The heights of the peak. The heights of a peak tells you something about baryon number density versus dark matter number density and things like that. The only thing that tells you about the tilt is the features here. If you can very carefully measure the spectrum here, then you learn something about the tilt. So things here don't really tell you about the tilt.
If it was far from scale invariant, then...
No, if it's far from scale invariant, then you would get...
That's what I meant.
But we're talking, let's, okay.
So I'm saying, so an alternative model of inflation would, in order to be consistent with this, it would have to produce an approximate scale of the
That's right.
For the ECM.
That's right. Absolutely. So what Raphael is saying that this physics, coupled with this data, tells us that given a scale-invariant power spectrum of adiabatic fluctuations on superhorizon scales before equal matter and radiation, that then you get the correct power spectrum of galaxies and you get the acoustic oscillations in the CMB angular power spectrum consistent with the data. And you get the baryon acoustic oscillations in the matter power spectrum, which is predicted in this picture. Okay. So, how does one obtain such a spectrum of cosmological perturbations with these properties? And this is where inflation enters. Inflation is the first theory based on causal physics, which predicts such a spectrum of fluctuations. But I'm going to argue that it is far from the unique one. So what are the requirements of a theory which has the right fluctuations? First of all, scales that we observe today must originate inside the Hubble radius. In standard cosmology, this is the Hubble radius, and in standard cosmology, there's no way to predict fluctuations on these large scales because they are larger than the horizon. So this is one condition. Second condition is that fluctuations must propagate for a long time on scales larger than the Hubble radius in order to produce standing waves. And finally, the mechanism for producing these fluctuations has to produce something that's approximately scale invariant. So these are the requirements. And I'm going to show you that inflation satisfies these requirements, but I'll show you two other cosmological models which satisfy these requirements. But first of all, for the non-cosmologists, I have to remind you of the difference between Hubble radius and horizon, and I have to remind you of the role of the Hubble radius. So you're all familiar with the horizon, which is the forward light cone of a point on the initial Cauchy surface. The horizon, that's a region of causal contact. Now, the Hubble radius is defined as the inverse of the expansion rate. It is a local concept. But it is relevant to the dynamics of cosmological fluctuations. It turns out that if you look at fluctuations on length scales larger than the Hubble radius, the fluctuations are frozen in. Only gravity matters. If you look at fluctuations on scales smaller than the Hubble radius, then microphysics dominates over gravity. So if you want to produce fluctuations using microphysics, you have to produce them on length scales smaller than the Hubble radius. So this is why the Hubble radius is relevant if we want to produce fluctuations using a causal mechanism. Now, in standard Big Bang cosmology, the Hubble radius is the horizon. There's no difference. And so therefore, in standard Big Bang cosmology, there is no way to causally predict the origin of cosmological fluctuations. And in any theory which can provide a mechanism for the origin of structure, the Hubble radius has to be different than horizon. So this is the picture in inflation. Space diagram of inflationary cosmology. So inflationary cosmology is a picture in which in the early universe there's a phase of exponential expansion of space. If you have exponential expansion of space, the Hubble radius is constant because the expansion rate of the universe is constant. So this curve is the Hubble radius. This is the phase of exponential expansion. This is the phase after inflation. After inflation, the universe is expanding as a power, and therefore the Hubble radius is increasing linearly. This curve shows the physical wavelength corresponding to a wave, a fluctuation mode. During the phase in which the universe is expanding exponentially, this wavelength expands exponentially. Afterwards, the wavelength expands as the scale factor. So in inflationary cosmology, scales originate inside the Hubble radius. They get expanded to become larger than the Hubble radius. They propagate for a long time on super Hubble scales, and then at late times they re-enter. So you see that these conditions are satisfied. Fluctuations originate inside the Hubble radius. They propagate for a long time on super Hubble scales. And I haven't explained the scale invariance yet. Okay. So, now I'll present an alternative to inflation for producing fluctuations in a causal way. And actually, I think there's a slight problem. This is a bouncing model. So let's assume that we have a new physics which generates a cosmological bounce. So time runs from minus infinity to plus infinity. This is time, this is space. So I take a bouncing cosmology, and I take a bouncing cosmology where the past is a mirror inverse of standard Big Bang cosmology. And I assume that there's some new physics which gives us a non-singular bounce. So new physics has to be assumed to give a non-singular bounce. So here I plot the Hubble radius, and I work in co-moving coordinates where fluctuations have constant wavelength, and these are the wavelengths of fluctuations. So from this space-time diagram, you see that fluctuations originate inside the Hubble radius, they propagate for a long time on super-Hubble scales, and they re-enter at late time. So, in this setup, the horizon is infinite. So the horizon is much larger than the Hubble radius. Perturbations are generated sub-Hubble. So two of the three conditions for generating the scale invariant spectrum are satisfied. And matter bounce, by that I mean that the early phase is matter-dominated. That will generate scale invariants, but I'll come to that later.
Is the Hubble radius actually blowing up?
Okay. Yes. So here, h is 0, the Hubble radius is infinite. Right, so the Hubble radius has... Very good question. So you are saying, actually, these scales, they are very, very briefly inside the Hubble radius again.
Yeah.
Now, in the models that we've calculated, it leaves no signal on very large scales. But that's a good question that you have... And we don't have a model-independent proof that it doesn't. But in different bouncing cosmologies where we've done calculations, we find that the infrared modes are unaffected. OK. So let me go back to inflation. In inflationary cosmology, it is usually assumed that fluctuations start out as quantum vacuum fluctuations. So we have a mechanism for producing fluctuations. Fluctuations become super Hubble, and they re-enter. So in a bouncing cosmology, let us assume again that fluctuations start in the contracting phase as vacuum perturbations. They exit the Hubble radius. And if the contracting phase is matter-dominated, then the adiabatic fluctuations acquire a scale invariant spectrum. The horizon problem is absent because the horizon is infinite. The flatness problem is absent because the universe is contracting and then expanding. So it's neutral related to the flatness problem. Size and entropy problems remain.
Do you mind going back to those 2 points? Because that was very good. How is the flatness problem solved?
So you see the.
You have a universe that was very not flat.
So the statement is that if we assume comparable flatness that is observed today at the corresponding point in the past, that's a level of the flatness problem that we have to, that's a level of flatness that we have to assume. So omega k, which is the energy density in curvature divided by the energy density of a flat universe, this is decreasing in the contracting phase. It's increasing in the expanding phase. So if we compare 10 billion years before the bounce to 10 billion years after the bounce, we have the same value of omega k. So
that's
in this sense...
That's because it's nearer t equals 0.
Yep. So in this sense...
But that doesn't explain why the curvature is small now.
Nope.
It says if the curvature was small,
the area
would be small.
Right. In standard Big Bang cosmology, the curvature has to be tuned in the early universe to be much, much smaller than the curvature limit now. So it's some, let's say, exponential tuning.
Oh, so it says if
here it's
if
order
the
one.
Previous cycle was big and flat, the present cycle will be big and flat.
Yep. Right. Okay. So it's neutral. Inflation, there we have an attractor. So in terms of a flatness problem, inflation is better than a bounce, because spatial flatness is an attractor during the inflationary phase. Here it's not an attractor, here it's just neutral. But it's better than in standard Big Bang cosmology.
What is meant by entropy problem?
Okay, so this is the entropy problem. This is the fact that we observe a very large entropy today. And if you assume that the universe was Planck scale at the Planck time, then you only have a Planck bit of entropy.
Okay, that's sort of more or less synonymous with the size.
Yep.
Question.
Yep.
Not a separate.
Not separate. They're related.
Size/entropy.
They're related. Yep. Okay, now since you asked me all these questions about this page, let me just mention why I'm less than keen right now on the bouncing setup, the anisotropy problem. There's a BKL instability. If you take a contracting universe with anisotropies, the anisotropies will blow up on you unless you have an ekparotic phase of contraction. So, but let's forget about the anisotropy problem for a while. I hope to have convinced you that there are other ways to generate fluctuations which are in agreement with the microwave data than inflation. Now the third scenario which produces fluctuations like we observe is what I call the emergent universe scenario. And here we assume that there's a phase in which the universe is quasi-static, which undergoes a phase transition to the standard Big Bang expansion. And our model for this early phase is a phase of strings at the Hagedorn temperature. So if you have a space-time diagram, if you have a evolution of the scale factor, like shown here, then the space-time diagram looks like this. Time and space, the Hubble radius is infinite in the static phase. It comes crashing down at the time of the phase transition and then increases linearly. Static phase means that the physical wavelength of fluctuations is constant. So, horizon infinite, much, much smaller than the Hubble radius. Fluctuations are generated inside the Hubble radius. Fluctuations evolve on super Hubble scales. And I'll show you later where the scale invariance comes from. So at this point, I've shown you three space-time diagrams that give you a causal mechanism of structure formation. And now I have to show you how scale invariance arises from those models. And now I will also argue that in inflation, of those three scenarios, inflation is the one that will predict the smallest amount of gravitational waves, not the largest. So now we have to become a little bit more quantitative. We have to study the origin and evolution of cosmological fluctuations. And cosmological fluctuations are inhomogeneities of metric and matter. So this is the metric with, and for matter, I will just take a scalar field for simplicity. So the background space-time is homogeneous. Everything blue is only time-dependent. And the red quantities are space and time-dependent. So we have matter fluctuations, they generate metric fluctuations. Delta phi and capital phi are related via the Einstein constraint equation. So if you plug this ansatz for the metric and for matter into the Einstein equations plus scalar field, into the Einstein action plus scalar field action, and expand to quadratic order about the background, then you get a quadratic action for cosmological fluctuations which has the form of a free scalar field with a time-dependent mass. There's a canonical variable, which is this combination of matter fluctuation and metric fluctuation. And the action for this perturbation mode is a simple scalar field form. And the time dependence of the effect of mass is given by the background spacetime. So given this quadratic action, you find that each Fourier mode evolves independently. And this is the equation of motion for each Fourier mode. And from this equation, you see that if you take small scales, large values of k, then you get oscillations like in Minkowski spacetime. Minkowski spacetime, this term is absent. Whereas if you take small wave, if you take large wavelengths, small wave numbers, then the dynamics is completely given by the dynamics of the background. So, and if you ask, when are these two terms equal, you find that this is exactly the Hubble radius. So the theory of cosmological fluctuations tells you that fluctuations will oscillate on sub-Hubble scales, but they are squeezed on super-Hubble scales. So first of all, the microphysical oscillations freeze out, and the amplitude of the fluctuation mode increases because of gravity. V is proportional to Z. Now let's go back to what Z is. Z is the scale factor modulated by this function of the background. And if the equation of state of matter is time independent, then this is a constant, phi naught prime over h. So if the equation of state of matter is constant, then z is proportional to a. Okay. So this is the equation of motion for fluctuations. If we have quantum vacuum initial conditions, these are the initial conditions. And the observable is the curvature fluctuation, which is this combination of background plus fluctuation variable. So what I have to show you now is that in inflation, in the matter bounds, and in the emergent scenario, you get a scalar invariant spectrum of curvature fluctuations. Now, there are not only cosmological fluctuations, but also gravitational waves. So to get the equation of motion for gravitational waves, this is a gravitational wave tensor, we plug this into the Einstein action, and we look at the induced action for each amplitude of the polarization tensor, and we find that the rescaled amplitude of the gravitational wave tensor obeys this equation of motion, which is identical to the equation of motion of cosmological perturbations, except that for cosmological perturbations, we have Z. And for gravitational waves, we have A. And I just argued that if the equation of state of matter is constant, Z is proportional to A. And therefore, gravitational waves will evolve in the same way as cosmological perturbations. So if you compute the ratio of gravitational waves divided by cosmological perturbations, you should expect something that is of order unity. Okay? So that's generically an early universe scenario will produce same amplitude of gravitational waves as cosmological perturbations. So it's nothing special about inflation that gravitational waves will be produced. In fact, if the equation of state of matter were independent of time, we would produce an amplitude of gravitational waves which is excluded by observations. So any model of early universe cosmology consistent with observations has to have a mechanism inbuilt which suppresses gravitational waves compared to cosmological perturbations. And in the case of inflation, it is a transition in the equation of state between inflation and late-time cosmology, which does the suppression, which is the inflationary reheating. In a balancing cosmology, it is a change of the equation of state in the new physics phase at the bounds, which enhances cosmological perturbations relative to gravitational waves.
When you say the equation of state is time independent, you mean the ratio of the pressure to the...
That's right. Yeah, that's right. Okay. So now there's an exception. If you have cosmological structure formation mechanisms in which the cosmological perturbations are created not by the standard mechanism, but by some entropic mechanism, then you might generate negligible gravitational waves and large cosmological perturbations. And the new ekpyrotic scenario falls into that category. And similarly, Galileo and Genesis models fall into the category. So often people only know about the ekpyrotic scenario and inflation. And since they have heard that the ekpyrotic scenario predicts no gravitational waves, they think that if you measure gravitational waves, you will have verified inflation. But this argument is wrong, because generically any model of structure formation which uses a standard mechanism of adiabatic perturbations will generate gravitational waves of comparable magnitude. And the ekpyrotic scenario is rather an exception. Okay, so now we have to be quantitative. And I now we'll run through a couple of slides where I will show you that inflation, the matter bounce, and the emergent scenario all produce a scaling down spectrum of cosmological perturbations. So here's inflation. So we start with a vacuum spectrum. And a vacuum spectrum is not scaling down. A vacuum spectrum, the power spectrum, which is defined as k cubed times Fourier mode square, is proportional to k square, because vacuum amplitude of zeta of k is k to the minus 1 half. So in order to generate scale invariance, there has to be something that boosts long wavelengths compared to short wavelengths. And for inflation, it's a fact that the v variable grows on super-Hubble scales. So if you run, and long wavelengths are larger than the Hubble radius, longer than short wavelength modes. So there's a mechanism in inflation which boosts the long wavelength fluctuations relative to the short wavelength fluctuations. And if you go through the algebra, you find that exponential expansion gives you exactly the right amount of boost of long wavelengths to turn the vacuum spectrum into a scaling invariant one. So inflation gives a scaling invariant power spectrum. Now for gravitational waves, the analysis is identical. You get a scaling invariant spectrum of gravitational waves. Now let's look at the bounce, matter bounce scenario. We start with a vacuum spectrum. It is not scaling invariant. The curvature fluctuations grow on super-Hubble scales. And if the universe is matter dominated during the phase of contraction, the dominant mode grows like this. And this power of minus one, which is associated with matter contraction, is exactly the right power which you need to convert the vacuum spectrum into a scaling invariant one. So matter dominated contraction is the equivalent of exponential expansion. Both turn a vacuum spectrum into a scaling invariant one. Again, the same thing happens for gravitational waves. Gravitational waves acquire a scaling invariant spectrum as well. So I've shown you that inflation and the matter bounce predict gravitational waves with a scaling invariant power spectrum, cosmological perturbations with a scaling invariant power spectrum. And the ratio of gravitational waves and cosmological perturbations is determined by the details. Now, in the emergent scenario, the idea is that we have a static phase filled with matter. And in this case, we can't assume vacuum perturbations. If this emergent phase is a phase in which matter is a string gas, then the fluctuations will be a thermal gas of strings. And we can use the same equations of motion as I showed before, except with different initial conditions. So let's run through the argument. The density perturbations are given by the energy density. So the cosmological perturbations are given by the energy density fluctuations. The gravitational waves are given by the off-diagonal pressure perturbations. In a gas of strings, we can compute these matter correlation functions. And if we evolve these matter correlation functions, we find that the density fluctuations are given by the specific heat capacity. There's nothing stringy about this equation. The specific heat capacity is determined by the radius in this way. This depends crucially on strings. And if we put everything together, we get a Skeynvand power spectrum of cosmological perturbations with a slight red tilt, like for inflation. And if we go through the calculation of gravitational waves, we find a Skeynvand spectrum of gravitational waves, but with a slight blue tilt. I mean, I'm going through very quickly these slides. So the bottom line is inflation, matter bounds. Sorry?
Tensor modes.
So this is a blue tilt for the tensor modes.
Blue tilt for the tensor modes, which is due to what? Presence of TH here?
Yep. So you're asking me now about the details?
Just a little bit.
Okay. So you see, if you look at this K, that's wave number. Scale invariance means that there's no K that appears here. But the K is hidden, because the temperature that's used here is a temperature when the mode exits the Hubble radius. And smaller wavelength modes exit later when the temperature is lower. So if you look at this factor, you basically find that small wavelengths have a smaller value of this factor. So therefore, you get a red tilt due to this factor. And you see, if you look at the gravitational waves, the factor is in the opposite, it's in the numerator. So therefore, you get a blue tilt. Physically, what the reason is that the pressure is small at earlier times. Gravitational waves are proportional to the pressure. And so therefore, the pressure for longer wavelength modes is smaller than for shorter wavelength modes. Therefore, you get a blue tilt.
Can you explain why it is a stringy effect?
Okay. The stringy effect, that's the overall scale invariance. This is this. So you see, if you get the specific heat capacity of a gas of point particles, you get R cubed. So this is where the stringing, where string theory enters. And that's crucial for getting scale invariance. Are you happy?
Just maybe a last question. In the string picture, usually the matter comes from perturbation of the string and the graviton comes from perturbation of the string. So why is there a different blue T directed behavior for matter versus graviton?
So you see, we start with the same partition function, but the pressure and energy density perturbations are given by different partial derivatives. One produces the
mass.
Yeah. So that's how this factor 1 minus T over T sub H arises different places. But the physical way of understanding it is through the pressure, and gravitational waves depend on pressure, being given by pressure perturbation. Okay. Good. So since I'm already a little bit over time, let me try to conclude. So I hope to have argued that B-mode polarization, shown you that B-mode polarization can be produced by different mechanisms than gravitational waves. Gravitational waves on cosmological scales can be sourced by non-primordial effects. For example, cosmic strings evolving between early universe and the present time. And then early universe models other than inflation can produce gravitational waves with the Skeynvand spectrum. And let me go back to the very beginning. Coming back to this slide. So now inflation predicts a red tilt. One of the three mechanisms which I showed you, namely string gas cosmology, predicts a blue tilt. The data is certainly in better agreement with a blue tilt than with a red tilt. And so therefore, going forwards, I leave you with this conclusion that, taken at face value, the current data rather disproves than proves inflation. Well, thanks. Okay, so you see that this is beautiful data. It's opening a new window. And we can really falsify inflation by measuring this spectrum more precisely. So if we can find that it is Gaussian, we can, if we find using topological analysis that it is not dust, if it really is cosmological, if we can measure the tilt, we can basically falsify inflation or determine that inflation has passed the further hurdle. So I think B-mode polarization might be the holy grail of early universe cosmology, even if it is not the holy grail of inflation. So I'm really looking forward to improved B-mode polarization data. Okay. Now, there are a lot of observation, a lot of telescopes which are taking data. There's a South Pole Telescope, ACT, the Atacama Cosmology Telescope. People in Toronto are working on the Atacama Cosmology Telescope. They are going to measure B-mode polarization with 6 frequencies. BICEP only has 1 frequency. With more frequencies than 1, you can distinguish dust from cosmological. So that's another way, other than topology, to discriminate between dust and cosmological signal. So with ACT, and ACT is also going to map 1/4 of the sky, so it's going to get to these crucial multiple moments. So I think with ACT data, in a couple of years, we will know much better. So I'm optimistic that we will know much more soon.
Really just an application of what you said, but isn't it true that there's a large range of inflationary models, and many of them produce far less B-mode or gravitational waves than this would? So it always struck me as strange that this was regarded as a proof for inflation, where it had the effect, its immediate effect was to rule out 90% of the inflationary models, and then it's regarded as proving the ones that are not yet ruled out.
Yeah.
Would you agree with that?
I completely agree with that. Right. Well, actually, maybe I should go.
But that's a more general issue. That's a much more general issue. To what extent inflation is tested.
So this is what I... In fact, the models which BICEP would rule out are the models in which inflation is under good effective field theory control. So, yeah.
Can you just elaborate a little bit on that?
Right. Okay. Unfortunately, I can't be too quantitative on this issue. But you see that So the amplitude of gravitational waves is proportional to h over m Planck to some power, where h is the value of the Hubble expansion rate during inflation. So now a large value of r implies large value of h during inflation, h close to m Planck. So now if you want an inflationary model at these high scales, you have to make sure that the model that you write down is safe from graviton corrections, graviton loops. And that's typically not the case.
I don't know how people are going to fight at this moment. So.
Right, so it's...
Any other questions? Can you elaborate a little more on the statement? Was at some point you said that it's sort of just a generic model that would produce fluctuations in an early universe, would produce far too much gravitation. Something special, if I understood.
Yes.
To get rid of it. So can you say a little more?
Right. So, okay, so what I argued is that the equation of motion for gravitational waves is the same as the equation of motion for cosmological perturbations. So, therefore, the amplitude of gravitational waves, the power spectrum of gravitational waves, divided by the power spectrum of cosmological perturbations, will be order one. In fact, if you look at the normalizations which are used in the literature, you would get an R value of 16 pi square.
Okay.
That's just be due to the different ways that people normalize things. So in order not to get 16 pi square as value for r, you need to have a mechanism which enhances the cosmological perturbations compared to gravitational waves. So you need to have a phase in which z deviates from a.
So what is r if this data is taken at fixed value?
0.2?
So that is order 1, so, and it may not have 16 pi squared.
Yeah, it's
not order 10 to the minus 6.
Yeah, that's right.
Like that. So it's not that bad. The other, I mean, it seems like you need maybe some suppression, but not a really dramatic one.
Yeah. Right.
So that's a further.
You need a controlled suppression.
Controlled suppression. That's kind of a further argument that a large. That if we had more models of the early, very early universe, they would all tend to produce something not far, not out of the ballpark.
Yep.
With what biceps claims to be.
That's the main point that I'm making.
Any other questions? Can you let me ask one last one? So, are you aware of the bounces in quantum cosmology? So, I'm wondering.
A little bit. Yeah. Yes, absolutely. And Edward Wilson Ewing has worked on that. Yeah. In fact, he collaborated with Oposok Ifu on this. So, loop quantum cosmology is one way of including the new physics that gives the bounce. Another is Hojave-Lifshitz gravity. That it gives you a bounce if you have non-vanishing spatial curvature. I'm mentioning that because you were working in Utrecht with Renata Lowe. There's a connection for you. So there are many different ways of getting a bounce. All of them require new physics. All of them suffer from this BKL instability. Accept models where you introduce an ekperiotic scalar field in the contracting phase.
Which means an unbounded low potential. What is ekperiotic scalar field?
An equation of state with pressure much larger than energy density.
Violating
an energy condition. So therefore, right now I don't particularly like bouncing models. I much prefer the emergent scenario.
Not then, let's thank Robert again.